from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is The Good Atheist.
Welcome to the goodatheist.net podcast. Hello, everybody. My name is Jacob Forte. Today, I have a very special guest. I managed to wrangle P.Z. Myers of Pharyngula fame over to the podcast, so hopefully that's going to go smoothly. We're using new technology here. We're using the internet to try to communicate, so it's not 100%. First, I'd like to say thank you to my guest. P.Z., thank you for joining me.
Oh, hello. No problem.
Now, for those of you that are not aware of who you are, now, I'm just going to basically put out there that you are essentially the royalty of atheist blogging. Would that be a fair title?
I'm too egalitarian for that. So no, I will not accept royalty.
Okay, not royalty then. All right. you're an elite blogger then in the atheist circles. Do you accept elitism?
We're all comrades together.
Okay, so you're a socialist. That's good. That's good. We're going to get along fine. I'm a Canadian, so, you know.
Oh, okay. You're all communists up there.
Right? Exactly. Well, communists. We call ourselves socialists over here, but apparently that's what you consider to be communism in the U.S.
Yeah, that's just nuance, right?
Exactly. That's nuance. So here's one thing that I noticed. Now, obviously, your blog is updated like quite a bit. Now, I try to do it full time, and you know, you're a difficult man to compete against in terms of just raw, the amount of just stuff that comes out of you. How do you manage to get so much done, honestly?
Gosh, everybody asks me that, but it's really just poor impulse control. You know, you just fire it off whenever it comes into your head, and it comes into my head a lot.
Well, you must have somewhat of a pretty advanced network of people, giving you news and that kind of stuff, right? It must be a bit overwhelming.
Oh, that's one big help. Yes, people are constantly mailing me stuff, so it's like my inbox here is just this torrent of things I just have to pick from. So yeah, that makes it easier.
So how did you get into this? Like, why are you blogging on atheism? And this is not what you're doing professionally, right? You work for a living.
We don't have an atheist clergy, so there's no money in this.
Don't I know it?
No, I'm a full-time college professor, and so mainly what I do is teach. That's what I spend almost all my time on, and the blogging stuff is just a sidelight.
Man, I I'm trying to do this full time, and you make me look bad. So I just want to put that out there, just one of those, just to clear the air, just so we don't have any bad.
Okay.
Vibes. Okay. So now that the jealousy is over, here's something I wanted to talk to you about, because obviously you have your main study, your field of study is biology. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you are particularly interested in what are they called again? The cephalopods? No, that's not it.
Oh, no, I'm particularly interested in developmental biology. Cephalopods are just another interesting aspect of that.
Here's something big that I want to talk to you about, because you can give me a feel of this. I'm in Canada, so again, you know, I try to put my feelers out in the webs and get a good idea of what's going on in the U.S. But I have to admit, really, what's the anti-vaccination movement that's kind of begun in the U.S. concerning this swine flu epidemic? Can you give me a feeler? What's going on? How big is this group that does not believe in vaccination? How big is this group in the U.S.?
Well, you're Canadian. You must know that Americans are all crazy, right?
Well, us Canadians are just as nutty. I don't know if you're aware of this, but a significant portion of our population is absolutely just as nutty. And
yes,
I've
been to Alberta, so I know.
That's a good example of the wackiness, yeah, Alberta for sure.
It's difficult to quantify because, interestingly, it's this whole business is one of those things that crosses political lines. So you've got crazies on the right and crazies on the left all fighting over vaccinations, and it's just insane because vaccination technology is well established. It worked. It works. It's been measured and quantified and analyzed out the wazoo, and we know that this is a reliable way to achieve immunity. And yet we've got these very loud, very vocal crazies that are just shouting out that, you know, Bill Maher is one, but we're also finding them on the right. It's a very strange phenomenon.
Oh, Oh yeah, well, one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up actually was because I wrote an article about Bill Maher and basically saying how he got spanked by Michael Shermer a little while ago when he posted something up on his site, you know, basically asking Bill to be, you know, a little bit more reasonable. I call it nice scientific spanking. This is how you guys sort of do it. You're always nice about it. You're nicer than I would be. I was basically saying that Bill Maher's being a fucking retard, and he just needs to sort of take a step back and take a look and say, well, you know, a lot of the rhetoric and all the BS that's coming out of his mouth is just pretty much stuff that's either been debunked a long ago, or it's just this mindless conspiracy nonsense. And you're just like, people should know better. And even on my site, even on my own site, my own fans, many of them were just saying, well, there are valid concerns concerning vaccination and so on and so forth. And, you know, my fan base isn't uneducated, but it just seems that even in the educated groups, there does seem to be a huge movement, you know, sort of saying vaccination is no good or it's ineffective. Like I've even heard, I was on a couple of sites, I've even heard a few epidemiologists saying that the current swine flu vaccination was or may not be effective. Are they being truthful or are they undermining the vaccination?
Well, they're being truthful because... This is the awkward part, is that it's not simply cut and dried. It's not a black and white issue whether that there are risks to getting the vaccination. Those are real, and they're aware of them. And at the same time, there's also this concern that many flu epidemics come through, blow through the country, and don't do much. That's always going to happen. So it's, you know, it's fuzzy on both sides, you know, the severity of the flu and the efficacy of the vaccine. But it still doesn't justify this kind of hesitancy that people are expressing. There are risks, but there's risks in everything. You know, these same people who are complaining about the vaccines, I bet you that every day they get up, they get in their cars and they go driving on the road, which is far more hazardous than getting a vaccination.
Well, I think I remember the statistics on vaccination was that you were twice as more likely to get hit by a lightning bolt, I think, than die from a vaccine. And yet these same people, you know, I think the odds are going through your entire life, if you drive a car, odds are about 1 in 100 that you might be in a fatal accident.
Yes. So it's weighing the risks, and people have this elevated sense that the vaccine is much, much riskier than it is. And so that's what these noisemakers on the anti-vax side are doing, is they're amplifying doubts and causing people to make foolish decisions because they have a poor estimate of the risks.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I was looking at was a bit of the history of the anti-vaccination movement before we were talking. And one of the things that I had found is actually there was a study that was publishing all the anti-vaccination literature and arguments that were being used in the 1800s. And these are many of the same arguments that are sort of coming back and resurfacing. And you're just like, has no one been paying attention here? This is all the same old bullshit.
That's right.
From way, 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 way back. So, you know, I think that there's a tendency, and it looks to me essentially that, you know, up until the 1990s, there really wasn't much of a concern. And you see this as sort of, there are periods where people are very aware of vaccination, and vaccination campaigns are very effective. And then everybody forgets about them, and then the disease has sort of like a resurgence.
Right.
And it always seems to me directly when the disease has a resurgence is when anti-vaccination rhetoric seems to be the strongest. And that also, it's almost paradoxical. When you're, so
right.
What is wrong with you people? You need to get vaccinated rather than try not to.
Yes. But of course, there's other factors coming to play now, too, is that these same people who are often promoting the evils of vaccination are also the people who are fighting against the evils of government, who've turned government into this big boogeyman that's out to get you. And so when you hear about a government program that's going to inject you with a virus, people freak out and think, well, hey, the government's out to get me again. And so it's feeding into this kind of
paranoia,
right? Political paranoia. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Well, it does seem to me that as a nation, I do have to admit that America is probably the most paranoid nation in the world, probably apart from maybe North Korea or something.
That's a good comparison, yeah.
Well, you know, not that I want to say that your lifestyles are necessarily just as bleak, but there does seem to be quite a bit of that paranoia. Now, here's another question I wanted to ask, and this is something that I don't think is being discussed, is the fact that I would say that in a person's life, there you can have different degrees of literacy about certain subjects. So I would say you're extremely literate about biology, but say perhaps you're illiterate about... Oh, I don't know. What's a good example? What would you say that you know the least about?
People are always asking me about the Big Bang, and I got to tell them I'm not a physicist. You know, that don't ask me what happened before the Big Bang. Get a physicist and ask them these problems.
Oh, okay. So just because you have that banner of science, they're like, can you answer all my science questions, please?
That's right.
Okay, so that's a good example, right? So you would fully admit to, in terms of physics, you're somewhat of an illiterate, or at least what degree of literacy would you say that you have regarding other sciences that aren't your field? Would you say that they're comparable? Would you say that some of them are low, or how would you judge these?
Oh, well, it's going to be all over the place. I mean, biology I feel fairly strong in, but even within biology, we've got sub-disciplines where I'd say... Hey, I don't know too much about that. I was recently approached by my colleagues, and we have a problem with filling some slots next year. And they said, "Could you teach biochemistry?" And I said, "No, I've taken biochemistry. I know enough biochemistry to understand its relevance to cell biology, and I can look things up. But ask me the details of an individual protein, I'm lost. I have to go hit the books and." It depends on what you want me to do. You know, I could probably fake my way through some biochemistry, but I could not teach it where you expect. You know, that's a place where you're expected to have a great depth of knowledge, and I don't.
Okay, well, don't worry, because this is not a grill session. It's just.
Oh, good.
Essentially, what I'm suggesting is what degree of do you think of honesty do people have about their own illiteracy concerning certain ideas. How scientifically illiterate do you think the American population thinks of itself compared to what it is? Do you think there's a disparity there, or do people know they're ignorant?
There's a huge disparity. You've heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
I'm not sure if I have. No. What is that?
Oh, they're a parapsychologist who did this study, and they discovered that people who know very, very little, who are truly ignorant, tend to overestimate their knowledge greatly because they're ignorant. They don't know how much they don't know. And at the same time, the people who really know their stuff tend to emphasize what they don't know, so that they underestimate how much they know. So there's this kind of convergence on the middle. But what it really means is that the people who know the least are the ones who are the most confident about how much they know.
Now, would you say, how does that play into this modern kind of movement in the U.S. that's been anti-intellectual, anti-elitist, as they would call it? So now you have sort of like the Sarah Palin type generation, sort of ignorant and proud of it, and declaring that everybody else who knows something is either wrong or emphasizing all the aspects that we are, I guess, questioning about our own, or being honest about, saying like, well, we don't know what it was like in the first, few milliseconds of the universe, and a person says, aha, you don't know anything.
Right. Yes. As if we don't know anything because there's something that we don't know. And that's not the way the world works.
What do you think, what do you think the situation is? How do you fix this, though? How can you fix this?
Oh, gosh. That's a big question. I don't know.
You don't know. That's a good answer, though. I mean, that's the honest first answer. The I don't know answer. All right. Well, that's good. That's acceptable. We could throw some, sort of like toss the ball around saying, well, what kind of things would help, like, because you don't know if you'll solve it, but you're like, what's the first thing, what's the biggest thing anybody can do right now to try to help the situation?
The part of the problem, I think, is really an issue of attitudes, that what we have going on right now is a country where there's very little respect for learning, that we've sort of somehow lost this tradition of thinking scholars are pretty good people. Right now, that if you talk to many people, they think that, for instance, a classic example is the Reverend Ray Mummert, who was a pastor in Dover, Pennsylvania at the time of the big Dover trial.
Oh, yes. Yes,
the Dover. Yes, he's the one who said, oh, no, we're being attacked by the educated elite of the country. It's like he thinks this is a great evil, that there are people who are smarter than he is and who think, and this whole issue of the word elite and elitism, being elite is not a bad thing. I wish we could get that through to people.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there's a bit of an irony there on say the internet or gaming sites. Everybody knows what elite means, and everybody's like, you got to pay respect to the people that are elite because they have the massive skills and they will destroy you.
Yeah.
So maybe
we need to start spelling it L33T.
I think so. Or forget the elite, just say elite, right?
Yes. We're the elites. We're the ones you want to respect.
Well, I always said that, you know, there's a terrible tendency, I think, for language to get hijacked, like the same way that say the word theory gets hijacked by intelligent design people, and you know, my idea was always that I know that scientists fucking hate doing this more than anything else, but I'm like, maybe it's time we look over at this nomenclature and declared, no, this is maybe this term is no longer acceptable. But it does seem kind of strange that nobody wants to budge on that,
because it's established, it's in the literature. You know, Richard Dawkins is trying this in his latest book, where he suggests replacing theory with theorem, spelled theorum.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I just don't think it's going to happen. It's so ingrained that people use words the way they like to use words. And that's really hard to get across, is changing nomenclature is just about impossible.
But, I mean, you're part of academia. So tell me this. Is there perhaps like a feeling amongst the majority of people in that feel that we don't really need to worry about this, and this is just stupidity and it'll go away, so that maybe one of the reasons they may not be accepted is because people just generally don't give a shit?
They care, but they're not aware. I'm going to be giving a talk at a big science conference next month, and that's going to be the subject of it. Is I'm going to be telling them that you've got to wake up and notice what's going on around you, because you know when you go to a science conference like this one I'll be attending, you're hanging out with all these like-minded people who do not argue about evolution. For instance, evolution is just there; it's accepted. It's part of the substrate that we're working on. And so you get into these groups and these little in-groups, and sit there talking, having a great time, and you lose sight of the fact that there's a whole bunch of people outside the convention hall who think you're insane, who think that God created the Earth 6,000 years ago, which is, to us, completely insane. And so there's this isolationism that we have to overcome. And it's a tough thing to convince people to waste time they could spend doing research on outreach to the public.
Well, I mean, look at yourself, right? I mean, I'm sure that that's part of your reality too. I mean, the amount of time that you spend on the blog or giving speeches, there's probably work that you'd be interested in doing that you might not be able to pursue because you might be saying,
"Oh yeah,
my efforts need to be put here." Am I right to some degree?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you talked to me 8-9 years ago, that at that time what I was doing is pure research. That's what I wanted to do. That's still what I'm really interested in doing. But then this other issue just sort of sucked my life away.
So how did it all start? Like, what was it that was that kicker? Like that moment where, you come to a fork in the road, and you're just like, well, what was that fork for you?
There was no fork. It was a very gradual thing.
It wasn't punctuated equilibrium. It was rather sort of like the old steady neo-Darwinistic kind of like a small
phylogenetic gradualism. Yeah, that's what it was. There was never any moment where I'd say all of a sudden, hey, I'm not a big name researcher anymore. I'm a big name popularizer. It just doesn't happen that way. The blog itself was sort of a hobby that I just did in my spare time. And even the first few years, I wasn't thinking of myself as that science blogger guy. I was thinking of myself as a guy who teaches genetics and physiology and things at the University of Minnesota Morris. But where it starts to change is, when you start going to conferences and people say, hey, I know you. And it's not because of what I published in science journals. It's because of what they've been reading on the web. And then when my colleagues are going off to conferences and this is the weird thing they're experiencing, they've got the name tag that says their name. It says University of Minnesota Morris. And everybody's coming up with them and saying, hey, you go to Morris. Do you know PZ Myers?
Nice, nice. I'm sure that doesn't create any resentment in the intellectual community.
Maybe a little
maybe
bit.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, come on. I know your groups. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, you want to be cock of the walk at any institution that you have. Come on now. Let's not kid around. So.
Except that, you know, in science, everyone has their expertise. And so we, you know, all of my colleagues know that I'm not sitting there thinking I'm better than they are because, you know, I'll go to them and I'll ask them about biochemistry and they'll be able to explain it to me. Or I'll ask them about ecology and they'll know so much more about it than I do. So that we each have our nice, tidy little domains of expertise that allow us a fair amount of confidence in what we do. So I don't think it's quite like you're making it out to be.
Well, I'm not. Okay, I don't want to. Yeah. I don't want to dramatize it. Anyway, I'm just saying that sort of we see the kind of same thing in all environments, professional environments. Where a person who gets a little bit more recognition always is a little bit like, you know, I'm not saying that it's spiteful. It's just more like, damn him.
Yes, they're at a conference and they want to be known for their work. They don't want to be known for this casual affiliation with some strange guy at their university.
And it must also be strange considering the nature of what it is that you're famous for as well, which is necessarily related to, you know, your field of study.
It's the controversy that, you know, I can see where a lot of people would not want to be associated with the controversial part of what I do.
Well, you know, me personally, I'm trying to actually make an atheist calendar with, you know, plenty of hot atheist chicks. One of the things that we found was really difficult is it wasn't so much finding the girls, it was convincing many of those girls to actually do it because either they or their families were like, no, you cannot be in this calendar. So it still kind of, it makes me see the degree of controversy.
What's the problem? Is it the atheism part or the cheesecake part?
It's the atheism part.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, a surprising amount of people seem to kind of be out of the closet in a very there's like two ways to be out of the closet. One is like you're upfront to people about your religion, and the other one is you're in everybody's face about it. You know, people like you and me, we're in everybody's face about it, and there's no going back. But not everybody obviously wants to be that much in your face, and I'm sure you're aware from, you know, kind of the letters that you get, the type of negative attention that sometimes brings, right?
Yes, there's a little bit of that.
What would you say the distribution is in terms of, say, emails that you get and stuff like that, distribution of the emails that are telling you you're going to go to hell compared to the other stuff saying, thank you so much for opening my eyes or something?
Oh, yeah, I've got a pretty good idea of that. It's, you know, like the majority of what I get is fairly casual. It isn't condemnatory and it isn't laudatory. It's just, hey, here's a question I have. So, you know, like 90% of it is that. When you look at the stuff that says, oh, you're a hero to me and you've done all this wonderful stuff versus all the stuff that says, I'm going to kill you next Tuesday. it's surprisingly, it's probably 10 to 1 that the stuff saying they like me is much, much higher than the stuff that says they're out to get me.
Now, do you ever feel sometimes like, you know, I mean, I'm sure to some degree it washes over you, but once in a while, it's just got to kind of feel kind of crappy to be threatened, right?
No.
No, you don't feel crappy about it? I don't know. Maybe I'm sensitive. Maybe if I was getting some of the letters that you were getting, and, you know, I'm probably even going to get worse letters than what you're getting if I ever get more, you know, notorious, but I, you know, maybe I'm just sensitive and getting those kinds of things just seems like it would just affect me. I don't know.
But the thing is, you know, the kind of people who will write letters saying they want to chop your head off are the kind of people you want to piss off. They're the kind of people that you feel good about not having on your side. So it's actually kind of self-affirming to get this mail coming in from these deluded nitwits who are saying these horrible things. Because, you know, if Richard Dawkins wrote to me and said he was going to come kill me, then I'd feel really awful. Okay.
I would love to read what you had to write to get him to do that. Honestly, if you ever managed to write that, please send it over. I need to read
it. Well, in that case, I would feel bad because I'd have to write something truly awful to get that to happen. But it's not happening. I get a lot of respectful praise from people who I also respect. So it's all working out fairly well that way.
Now, here's a question that I try to ask everybody, because this is something that I don't know if you've noticed this, but every time I seem to meet somebody who's either a fan of the show or when they write to me, a lot of people ask me, what is it that you're reading? Do you find that this is a common question? Do people ask you, what are you reading? What should I be reading?
Oh, I get something worse. They're all asking me when my book will be done.
So are you working on a book? Is
yes,
an announcement
I am.
That I should be making here? There's a book in the
works. No, it's oh, everybody knows this. You haven't been reading my site very carefully.
Hey, that's not fair. That is not fair, all right?
Yes, I've mentioned it there a few times. Yeah, I'm working on a book. It's actually sold. Got a contract and everything. I have a deadline of January 1st for getting it done.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty ambitious. That's coming up.
Yeah.
But you know what? You seem pretty productive, so I have good faith that I'm sure it's chugging along, right? Can I give news that it's chugging along?
Oh, of course it is. Yeah, I've got half a dozen chapters done, and I'm working on, and I'm going to have another one done this evening, I hope.
See, half a dozen. I mean, now other people are going to laugh at me and my unwritten book and just say, like, ha, you know, PZ Meyer is way ahead of you. He's got 6 chapters, and you're still on number 1. Showboating again.
Yeah, well, it's a bit anxiety producing right now. So I've like I said, I've sold the book and I've talked to publishers and I've talked to my agent and we know what I'm supposed to do. And the thing they're all telling me I have to do is I have to write this atheist book and it has to be funny.
Don't you just love when they say that, you know, sort of, well, make sure it's funny. You're just like, well, what the hell is supposed to be funny?
Yeah, it's putting a lot of pressure on me. I can be casually funny. I can throw off something that people find hilarious, apparently, but I can't try and be funny. So that's my struggle right now.
It's trying to hit the right key, trying to hit the right note.
Yeah, so I have to sort of get my brain in this state where I don't care anymore, and I'm not working to be funny. I'm just writing and throwing off ideas and. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but that's what editing is for. Is you go in there and you later throw out the ones that didn't work.
I tell you what, you know what's good for inspiration? I've been watching a lot of his comedy recently. Louis C.K., definitely. He inspires me to be funny. Of course, he's a bit more, you know, graphic than what you might be accustomed to. So I don't know how
that might
work.
I find I can't do that because then I start thinking, well, hey, can I steal that?
I think a lot of that stuff kind of happens casually anyways. And I think, I don't know if you're of the same opinion of me as me, as I think generally, cause I know I put up a post, an editorial post, I remember, and somebody commented later and said, oh, well, you know, you're stealing this person's work and it's theft and so on and so forth, and they should be paid for it. Now, here's an interesting question that I have for you, because you're a blogger, but you're also going to write, is that where's that line where sort of like a person is writing things in order to become, you know, to gain a reputation on the web and in order to be able to just fucking get eyeballs, and compare that to sort of stuff that, you know, we try to hide or try to charge for, or try to, you know, like, you know, like that content wall. So
yeah.
In your opinion, how does somebody juggle from that? Like say a person out there who wants to blog, because I'm sure lots of people listening are thinking, I want to start my own atheist blog. What is your recommendation to these people when it comes to this kind of thing?
Well, I'm one of those who sides with just being completely open. So I'm for instance, I often get requests from people that they want to republish something I wrote in their Polish blog or their Armenian blog or whatever. And I say, yes, go ahead, please do. So I just throw it out there. I figure if it's on my blog, it's openly available. Anybody can use it, you know, it would be nice if they gave attribution and a link back, but that's all I expect. This book does create new issues because the publishers want something fresh. They don't want to just recycle what I wrote on the blog. So there's a whole bunch of stuff I'm writing that normally I would throw it on the blog, and I'm not. And that feels very strange to me right now.
Bit of a dichotomy, right? So do you feel sometimes that you're not even giving some of the gold away because you have to lock it behind to sort of like to make the book? Or you're just like, oh, I wish I could talk about it, but I fucking can't.
That's how I feel, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, like right now, the chapter I'm working on right now is I'm writing about this whole issue of whether atheism is science or whether it's metaphysics. And I, you know, it's sort of inspired by some recent posts by Massimo Piliocci and Jerry Coyne have written on this recently, and I've got my own take on it. And it's stuff that normally I would say, "Hey, this is my blog post." Boom, And I'm not doing that. It just feels so odd. It's like I'm holding back from everybody.
And, well, you're dealing with, you're in two worlds now. And that's, yes, that's got to be weird. Because, you know, one of the things that I try to, that I'm trying to do is I want to avoid, like, essentially the pitfalls of, well, they don't seem like pitfalls, but the pitfalls of publishing. Because I actually think that I hate the idea of limiting my own content. But yes, I can definitely see how that must be sort of like a weird thing to have to work with, because there's right, that line where you have to say, well, no, this has to be kept for the book, and meanwhile you're just like, but I want to give it away.
Yeah, of course, where I compensate is I figure, you know, usually I churn out half a dozen things a day, so I just say, well, so I give five to the web and one I hold back.
Well, you know what? That's what I was saying before. Your proliferation of posts. Yes. How prolific you are is almost embarrassing to those of us that try to do it full time.
Yeah. Of course, at the same time, what you write for the book has to be higher quality than what you throw out, you know, on the web. I rarely edit, and I just, you know, it's just off the top of my head. But this stuff for the book, I've got to rethink and rewrite a couple times. And it's different.
Well, here's a good question then, and this, I think, because I've been reading a couple. Did you read, there's an article, and Sam Harris put it up. It was from Newsweek, and it was just basically saying that right now atheists are, the author was comparing us to a bunch of adolescents boasting about our own ideas and so on and so forth. And although, you know, I also felt this was just pretty, heavy-handed kind of writing, there was one thing that I think kind of struck me, and it was just kind of an idea that popped in my head, but the one idea that I had is, what is it that atheists should be talking about the most? You know, like, what issue is the most pressing to you feel?
Science. It's going to be different for every atheist, right? That there will be atheists who are concerned about the law, who are concerned about morality, mm-hmm. and, you know, in the case of people like me and Richard Dawkins, it's science and education. We're all going to have these, and one of the reasons many of these atheists are being so vocal right now, you know, these so-called new atheists, is that we keep running into this darn barrier to advancing our true causes, you know, like science education. And the barrier is religion. So, you know, it's like we've all got our pickaxes out and we're pounding on this stupid wall in front of us. And we're trying to get through that so that we can stop worrying about the wall and talk about these other issues.
Well, it definitely always seems, especially with religion, that it's just one of those things where you're not supposed to talk about it and everybody's supposed to be cool about it. But, I mean, back with what we were talking about vaccination, what's interesting, in the 1990s, there was an outbreak, I think, of whooping cough. And it was specifically in this one religious demographic that had selected not to get the vaccine. Uh-huh. And as a result, actually, because they were just, I guess they had created a new potent strain and a bunch of people died. And this is one of those things where even in the U.S., the anti-vaccination movement was largely a religious movement because they felt, well, if you get vaccinated and God wants to kill you from smallpox, then you prevented God from killing you.
Yes.
So you've now engaged in sin. And I think it's kind of interesting the fact that they've now moved away from this kind of cell, because it seems like a harsh cell now.
Uh-huh.
I guess back in the day that wasn't quite as harsh. Everybody was like, yeah, God's killing people. Fuck yeah. But
yeah.
Now it just seems that, you know, they're going back and creating different types of arguments. But I still feel at the end of the day, it has a lot to do with this unreasoning idea that, well, we shouldn't be altering anything that's natural, and we should let nature take its course.
Yes, and that's sort of what I get from Bill Maher, too, is he's all for these natural remedies. But the thing is that vaccination is taking advantage of your natural properties thoroughly. That's what it is. It's ramping up a natural system that you contain to fight off these diseases. And then so I can't think of anything much more natural than doing that.
I suppose it harkens back to this idea that if it's nature, it's good. And it's weird because don't you feel that there's this kind of odd dichotomy? Because most people who study nature view it as insanely cruel, barbaric. And those who don't think of it as some kind of magical Disney utopia.
Yes. Yes, that nature is not made of chemicals. and then silly little tropes like that. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it just seems as though, again, like I was going back to the point of people trying to, you know, having to finally admit their own illiteracy about things, and it's just, it seems as though most people are really not willing to admit their own scientific illiteracy, and I think that's sad. Mm-hmm. It just seems such a shame, and you know, I'm gonna make this broad statement. I don't know if it's true, but in my mind, the reason I think that science has been undermined has I think a lot to do, ironically enough, with the fact that the Soviet Union isn't what it used to be. Without somebody scaring the shit out of you, it seems as though you can't get most of your population under control.
That played a role. That I was a recipient of the Sputnik scare from the 50s. You know, I was educated in the 60s and 70s, where it was still going strong, that we were in a race with the Ruskies and we had to be smarter than they were. And that's kind of dissipated now, hasn't it?
It feels like almost like who are the, like, because you know, until then, basically, it was illegal to teach evolution even in schools. And then all of a sudden, yes, you got the scary Ruskies. Okay, goodbye these stupid laws, and let's get back to science. And now that enemy is gone, it doesn't seem like a coincidence that these same old issues that you used to have a problem in the 50s are back.
we've got to feel more fear of the Chinese, I guess.
Why does your population have to be motivated by fear? Why fear? You know, is there nothing better to stimulate Americans than fear? I don't know why that's the avenue to go.
It's very effective for human beings all over the world. That fear is a good goad to get people to do things.
Yeah, but you know, the rest of the world kind of takes on that whole Maslow's hierarchy of need thing and says, well, you know, cover the basics, and then after that, people can try to have aspirations.
Well, yeah, but then again, you know, not to be jingoistic or excessively patriotic here, the United States is really kind of pushed the edge for many years on science and technology, and I think that the fear part has really helped, that Americans aren't complacent. Well, they are now, but you know,
they won't be in 2 years when a new scary boogeyman comes over.
Yes, that fear will whip them into shape again. Canadians are so nice and mellow and casual about everything, and
we don't do anything in this country. I'll be honest with you. I think in 150 years we've barely done anything. We established our constitution in 1981.
I wouldn't say you've done nothing, but you know, it's like the pace is not quite as intense as it has been in the U.S.
Well, the pace in the U.S. now, though, seems, I mean, quite honestly, to have completely stalled, though.
Because we've got all this frenetic energy in the United States, and right now it's all turned inward, and it's wrestling with, you know, really stupid crap like, you know, what are we going to do about the gays? You know, how can we, you know, we're freaking out over gay marriage and all this stupid social stuff that shouldn't be an issue, that isn't an issue in Canada. But it's eating us alive down here. That this is what people are most concerned about is, you know, like if you read, what's that book? You know, What's the Matter with Kansas?
I don't think I've ever heard of this book now. What's the matter with Kansas? Probably the answer, a lot, maybe?
Oh, well, but the thing is, Kansas used to be this really wonderfully progressive state. And what has happened to them? Well, the right exploited their fear on social issues and has Kansans actively undermining their own economy because they're so concerned about things like abortion and gay rights and so forth that it's become this big issue there that tears the country apart. So Americans are still just as ambitious and just as excited, just as ambitious and excited about the wrong, stupid things, and it's ripping us apart.
Now, here's my last question to you now. Here's a challenge. It's actually not quite a question, but rather a challenge that I want to hear if you think this is a good idea or a bad idea. And as an American, this is the quintessential question. What would you say to the idea of launching America in a new age of reason and science by adopting the metric system? What do you think?
I already have.
Well, you have, but I think America as a country, to make that change and say we are ready to be a country of science, do you think that would be a good idea? Like, just to show us that you still got the balls and the science and the brains, switch over to the metric system.
I think it would be great. I think this is what we ought to have done years ago. I remember in the 70s, there was a big push to go all metric in this country.
And what happened to that?
Well, it was exposed as a Canadian plot, of course.
Canadian plot. Must be.
It just became one of those things where, you know, people dug in their heels and they said, no, that you're changing too much. That they bought into this whole idea that tradition is more important. And yes, it also got associated with Europeans. You know, you must have heard this stuff in this country about France, right?
Oh yeah, like your disdain of France, despite the fact that France and America, especially during the foundation of your country, were like best friends.
I know. Yes, that they shared so many of the same ideals with us. That, you know, we'd be like Canada now if it weren't for the French. Maybe there's a reason we don't like the French. Anyway, you know, so there's this whole issue of this opposition to European ideas, which is so peculiar. And the metric system is considered a European idea, and people rejected it.
And well, the meter was a French invention. So that's why I thought that it was always so weird, because only until recently has France been considered an enemy. But before then, I mean, how many Statues of Liberties are there? You guys have one, but I mean, they have a bunch, but
yeah.
I'm like, what? So much hate on for the French, and yet your peoples were so close.
Right, and it's totally irrational. The metric system is wonderful. Once you get used to the metric system, you don't want to do anything else, because it's so easy to calculate everything. You know, why do we have to worry about miles per gallon?
I don't even know. what is an inch based on? What is that based on? Like the length of a half a thumb of king of England or something?
It's something like that. It's a foot divided in 12, of course. And once upon a time, a foot was the length of, what was it, the French? Oh, that was French. It was a French king who decreed this, I think.
Oh, no, those French always measuring things.
Maybe it goes even back to Charlemagne. But it was supposed to be the length of the foot of a ruler. And that's been subdivided into 12 because for some reason people like something divided by twos, threes, and fours. And so, oh, come on, let's just go back to the metric. Yeah, I agree 100%.
So do you think America can do it? Can America switch to the metric system? Does it have the capability?
Oh, do we have the capability? Yeah, but do we have the will? And no, we do not have the will.
That's why I'm calling out as a challenge here. I'm putting out that challenge to you, as an American and as a scientist.
But the thing is that if I had to get up there and fight for a particular issue, it would not be the metric system.
Okay,
Fair enough. I would rather fight for equal rights for gay people. I would rather fight for, you know, better science education. I'd rather fight for evolution, things like that. And once we've cleaned up those little issues, then let's go back and get rid of inches and feet.
Well, you know, that sounds like a plan, and I think that's the end of the show. So I'd like to thank you again, Mr. Myers, PZ Myers, everybody. Give him a hand.
Been fun. All right.
All right. Thanks a lot, PZ.